Well, if you are sitting comfortably, I will begin on this fifth or sixth book. Six already! Wow! I must have missed one. Where was I yesterday? On this sixth talk of the Easter retreat, 9-day retreat 2018. So yesterday I was talking a lot about some insight, how it works. In other words, to be able to see the problems in meditation, to see how things work, and from there to just have more skill to get into some great meditations, and on the way we understand not just how this mind works, but just how the whole universe works. So this is important, because it, as we meditate more and more and we learn more about the practice of calming, freedom, liberation, this is actually where we understand just about why, how we get reborn and how we can stop getting reborn. So just one little anecdote which just comes to mind about some insight and how it relates to your meditation. Remember yesterday I said if it's real insight, you know it's real insight because it works. You see things a different way and it creates a lot of peace and stillness and freedom, happiness in you. And that was a story when I used to go teaching in the prisons. And when I was teaching in the prisons, after a while, I couldn't go there anymore because I got too busy doing lots of other things. And then this other monk went to the prison, and that's where they asked him to stay behind a little bit longer and so he can have a cup of tea, some cheese, and just to ask about monastic life. What's it like being a monk at Bodhinyana Monastery? Now you may go over there and you think, oh, what a peaceful place it is. But some of us have to work there. So we actually describe what it's like at Bodhinyana Monastery, a day in the life of a good monk. And we said we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And straight away, when we said that, the prisoners were aghast. They were shocked. They were discombobulated. One of my favorite words. You don't have to know what it means. How it sounds is what it means. 4 o'clock in the morning. Even murderers don't have to get up at that time. What bad karma did you do to have to get up at 4 o'clock? And, of course, the old joke, it's optional. You can always get up early if you want to. But then they said, what do you do? Can you watch the TV? Get the late night movies? We don't have TVs in monasteries. Not in my monastery, anyway. You know, when I was in Thailand, there was quite a well-known forest monk. And somebody came up to me, so sad. I said, well, what happened? You know, he's got TB. And that isn't bad. TB in the old days was, you know, curable. You know, a few antibiotics or whatever. TB is easy. He said, no, you didn't hear correctly. He's got TV. I said, that's incurable. You know, sometimes when they put me in hotels, there's a TV in there. And they ask me, Ajahn Brahm, did you watch the TV? I said, yes. I looked at the TV. And I said, it's fascinating. You look in the TV and you go up close. You can see your own reflection in the glass in front. They were supposed to turn it on. Oh, I didn't realize that. That's the only way to watch a TV, when it's turned off and you have a look in there. You can see your reflection in there. Mindfulness. Anyway, where was I going? So we don't have TVs in monasteries. And so what else do you do in the morning? You meditate. And then what do you have for lunch? And of course, you know, when we're over here, we have a really good lunch. But over there, you can watch me over there, I have a cup like this with 3 Weetabix and a cup of tea. Or maybe some banana in it, or mango or something. That's it. That's my breakfast. Wow! Over in the prison, you can have whatever you want. You can have bacon and eggs and pancakes and fruit. You can have noodles and what's the Thai noodles, which is always really famous? Not yum yum, is it? No. It's yum yum. Yum yum noodles. You can have fish, you can have kippers, you can have whatever you want there. You can have muesli, 10 different types of muesli. You can have eggs, whichever way you want. Sunny side up, sunny side down, rainy side up. You have rainy side up. Sunny side up. Whatever you want, you can have for those. That's all you have over there. Wow. And then what do you do? And then we work. It's not just to see the monks over there just working in the office over there, doing all sorts of stuff. And then Venerable Nito making sure the camera's over there and ordering the headphones so you can get the best headphones there. We're over there now doing sort of all sorts of work, whether it's fixing up the plumbing, getting the water right, doing all of the maintenance. There's a lot of work we do. And so we work really hard. And of course, I work hard too. In the old days when you'd let me. I remember sometimes you're on the roof fixing it. And you get somebody like, I remember when Professor Lucky Jayasurya came. You know, he's Emeritus Professor of UWA. He said, "Where's Ajahn Brahm?" He said, "He's up on the roof." You're not really supposed to have a teacher, you know, up on the roof fixing the plumbing. But I enjoy that. And especially concrete. Concrete work is the best. I don't know why, it's just sometimes, it's a boy thing. And maybe not, that's maybe gender specific, but I really got into it. So, you know, mixing concrete here, mixing concrete there. So anyway, so we work really hard. Well, it's fun. And it kept you healthy in those days. So, then, they said, never make us work hard like that. What do you have for lunch? And you see the lunch, well, there's a lot of lunch there, but everything has to go in the same bowl. Over in Bodhinyana Monastery. Even yesterday, we had some ice cream, and I put it in there. What did it get into in the end? I think it got, that's right, the shepherd's pie. I had shepherd's pie with ice cream. You ever had that before? You haven't lived till you've had mashed potato with ice cream on top. It goes in all in one bowl. So, that's disgusting. Said the prisoners, this all gets mixed up inside anyway. And it reminded me of, I don't know, some of the nuns there may know the monk, I don't mind saying, this is a nice monk, a friend was Ajahn Sucitto, that he was in this monastery in the north of England for 3 months. And they didn't have much food there. And it's only about 3 or 4 monks. But he used to get the big, you know, the 11-litre buckets, the plastic ones. And whatever was left from the day before, he'd put in the bucket and put it in the freezer. In the morning, they would thaw it out. And whatever food came that day, whether it was potatoes or rice, whether it was vegetables or pudding or mangoes or whatever, or curry, he put it all in the top with a big spoon, stir it up. Stir it all up. Nice and, warm it up and stir it up. And then he'd pass it down the line. Anyone could take as much as they wanted. And then what was left over, put it in the freezer for the next day. So that saved a lot of washing up. Saved a lot of, choice. Because if you go over to Bodhinyana, there's so much choice. Even over here, there's so much choice on the tables there. Some people will take forever. To imagine, maybe ask Bianca to do that this afternoon. Put it all in one, stir it up. It would go much faster. And he did that for 3 months. And at the end of the rage retreat, everyone left.
Macs get out to weird things. It's a really nice Mac, though, that Mac. But anyway, there we do stuff like that. So that's disgusting. So then what do you do? In the afternoon. Yeah, meditate, rest, do some more work. So can't you sort of, you know, do some sports? Would monks be good at sports? Yeah, maybe that I saw on passing in the airport. They have these competitions actually with darts. And you can make thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars that way. Imagine just with the power of the mind. Bullseye, 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 bullseye. Very easy, wouldn't it? But then would that be cheating? What about playing golf? You just get some big samadhi, and you hit the ball, and it maybe go way past the hole, but you know, with a bit of samadhi, you get it to come back again, and just come in the hole. Would that be called cheating? But no, we don't play sports. And you heard this one before, but you know, I did actually think when I first came here with Ajahn Chakra just to get some interfaith harmony, just getting a soccer team or a football team, so we can actually just play with the Christians or the Hindus or whatever. It's a great way of actually getting some harmony together. But then I thought, if you're playing, say, soccer. Because the AFL, that's the Australian rules, that's a bit violent. So soccer, but then what would happen? Play soccer in a Buddhist team. You'd always have to play by Buddhist principles. Number one, let go. If they wanted the ball, have it, come on. Number two, compassion. Which meant that if the other team couldn't score a goal, you score one for them. Come on, here it is. That's one of the reasons I keep telling people in Thailand the Thai soccer team never gets to the World Cup. Too many Buddhists. But anyway, so we don't play sport, we meditate. Oh, meditate all day. And then what about in the evening? What time do you have dinner? Dinner? We don't have dinner, a cup of tea and a lump of cheese, but only over here, over there, just get chocolate. That's disgusting. Then, what do you do in the evening? We play poker. No, we don't play cards, we meditate. And that's actually when, I remember the monk who told me this story, because I sent him up there to do the talks, and he said, the prisoners actually asked him, don't you ever get tired of meditating? And he said, sometimes. He's being honest. Like, you know, same with you sometimes. You know, you just want to go and take a rest. But anyway, so then what time do you go to bed? Bed? We don't have beds. Go and have a look at my cave. We've just got a little mat on the floor. And actually, because I did read in the Australian newspaper or something, that because people are always worrying about getting killed by sharks, they said that more people are killed falling out of bed than they are killed by, bitten by sharks. That was in, I think, some research done. So I'm safe. Because I sleep on the floor. You can't fall out. You're not on the bed. So whichever way you roll, you can never fall out. You can't. But be careful of beds. They're just very dangerous. Sleeping on the floor is really great. It also means I never get up on the wrong side of the bed because I haven't got one. That's terrible. Don't have beds. You don't have evening meal. And they were genuinely concerned for their friend. And what they said next was a classic. It actually happened. The best funny stories are not what you make up, what actually happened. Because one of the prisoners looked at him and said, that's terrible in your monastery. Why didn't you come in here and stay with us instead? I was in Casuarina jail. And the prisoners had a point. It's much more comfortable in a top security prison than it is over here in Bodhinyana Monastery. Better food, you can watch TV, you can play sport, you don't have to answer any questions.
it. But before you go any further there, I'm not going to volunteer to go to jail. But one of the things was why? Why in jail people are trying to get out? Why in Bodhinyana Monastery and in Dharamsala there's a long waiting list of people trying to join? Why? What's the difference between Bodhinyana Monastery or even Jhana Grove and a prison? The only difference is in a prison you don't want to be there. In monastery or here, you want to be here. That's the only difference. And that tells you what freedom is and what imprisonment, suffering is. Any place you don't want to be is your prison. If you're in a relationship, a marriage you don't like, your marriage is like a prison for you. That's why they have those two rings. They're called handcuffs. And any job you hate. I don't want to be in this job. It's like you go to work in the morning and you're just really just, what am I doing this for? Your salary, your wage is only a bribe to get to do something you'd rather not do. So your job, your office feels like a prison for you. You're in a body which is old and aching and sick, and your body's like a prison for you. Or even you're in a meditation retreat and you're counting the days until you can go somewhere else. You don't really want to be here. Then this place is a prison for you. Any place you don't want to be is called prison. Oh, how do you escape from the prisons which you make from your perceptions of your life? It's so easy once you get to understand what a prison is. You want to be here. My husband, he's not the best, but he's good enough. I could get worse, much worse. My wife, well, she's not exactly Taylor Swift, but is that right, Taylor Swift? Good, I don't know. But she's good. The food, it may not be as spicy or whatever you like as you can get back where you live, but it's good enough. So it means you're happy to be here. Your job is good enough. What else did I say about this meditation retreat? Can't we do something about these millipedes? Always stepping on them and just, can't we have quiet cooties? Ajahn Brahm, can you please make a list of all those people who snore at night? And put them all in like the snoring cootie, furthest away than anything else. So it doesn't disturb us. Okay. You made a prison for yourself. You don't want to be here. So instead, you say, I want to be here. And then you're free. This moment, what's it like right now? Is it not good enough? You want some jhanas? You want another joke, it's not a stupid joke, you want to laugh or whatever. But right now, this moment, are you happy to be here? If you are, you are free. That's what contentment means. And you can find contentment anywhere, in any place, at any time, when you can know how it all depends upon how you look at this moment. Wanting to be here means you're free. Wanting to be here means that you have nothing, no craving, no place to go. You are content. So this is what we learn from going to prison. Learning, wanting to be here, it's not a challenge. So, how does that work in meditation? I was going to carry on from some little meditation methods which I mentioned yesterday of the kids' meditation. Remember when I was talking about just imagining you're sitting here and you're flowing out of the body over to the beach, your own private island. And why does that work? The reason it works is because you put yourself in a position, imaginary, you'd change your perceptions to one of contentment. Now, for grown-ups, if such things actually exist, what I have sometimes asked is, can you remember one of the happiest moments of your life? Okay, this is going into the past, but it's using something from the past to come into this moment and assist the meditation. The happiest moment in your life, I don't mean exciting, you know, when when Sri Lanka won the Cricket World Cup, or, you know, when your first kid, you know, appeared, or, I don't know, the other exciting, when you won the lotto or something. I'm talking about the times where you were, wherever it was you were on planet Earth, that you felt so happy, so content, that you didn't want anything to be different. The people you were with were the ones you wanted to be with. No one was missing. The weather was just nice. Nothing to do. But if you found a little bottle and then rubbed it and a genie came out and said, is there anything you want? You have 3 wishes. You say, not today, thank you. I'm happy enough right here. We had those moments, and sometimes those moments, it's amazing how you can have so much contentment. You know, it's not just the most wealthy environment. It's not just, you know, just the most amazing people. It's just your friends, your loved ones, or you're just by yourself. Totally content, not wanting anything to change. Really wanting to be there in that moment with those people or by yourself. We had those experiences before, utter contentment. You know, sometimes, you know, I had sometimes those, well, actually quite many times, just sitting down, maybe just here outside the kitchen with a cup of tea. Just sitting down, perfectly happy, content, not wanting anything in the whole world. Almost that if the world time stopped, you'd be just so content. Those are moments which are teaching you something. Teaching what letting go is. Teaching you about how happiness is always there for you when you stop seeking something else. But how peace is the default state when you stop wanting. When you stop going anywhere, you find you are more than good enough. This moment is really beautiful. And it doesn't matter, you may be sick, you may be in trouble, you may have all sorts of work to do afterwards, but right now, this moment is good enough for the purpose of being free. Now, hopefully that many of you had those sorts of moments. I remember just some of them are just even just doing some work to try and save some money to get to, actually that's when I went on the first pilgrimage to India as a, that bird. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. Reminded me of just sometimes this little lake when I was a student this was at Darwin when I did a teaching course, and just there's this really lake in the middle of nowhere, and sometimes I'd go there and just, so many birds were around there, just sit down and listen to the birds all afternoon. Not really doing anything. I was not an ornithologist. I just enjoyed this, the peace and tranquility, just being there. So often that's the case. I do remember of this time when I was walking, again in the north of Scotland as a student. Sometimes those days were so sunny and they were idyllic. And I was walking along a coast road in the far north with this single lane bitumen road winding around the headlands, and just looking out over to the ocean. All these beautiful velvet green islands, small ones stretching out as far as you could see. And it was a calm day, so the sea was only slightly rippled. It almost looked like the bark of a tree. And it was glistening, and just very deep blue, because the sky was blue that morning. And the wind, which created those little ripples on the ocean, that was just wafting this really nice sea breeze over me. And it was just such an idyllic morning, and I didn't really have any much of a destination, plenty of time to get there. So I was just walking and just stopping and looking every now and again at the beautiful, beautiful seascape. Just almost totally alone. Until I saw there was a car which was parked up further ahead. And there's a little bay where people could park. The first car I'd seen for a couple of hours. I just wondered what the person was doing, but I was in no rush. I was just enjoying the scenery. And as I came to the car, just really getting high on a beautiful morning in Scotland, in the Highlands, by the ocean. You know what I saw? I looked through the window, and there's this big Scotsman there who was reading the newspaper. I couldn't believe it. You're reading the newspaper when a millimetre or two on the other side of that newsprint is this beautiful seascape and islands and sunshine and a few little gulls and terns just gliding in the air currents. Oh, it's just beautiful. And what was he looking at? The sport, the scandal. You know what I thought of doing? Because I did have a little pair of scissors in my backpack. And I thought of getting them out and cutting a hole in his newspaper so you could see what was the other side of that newsprint. Well, in those days I was really thin and scrawny. And this was a big Scottish fellow, so I thought, I better not. But I always remember that. Why is it we got so much happiness and joy? Such a beautiful morning. We spend our time on the newsprint of life, on the scandals, the dramas, the sport. What else is there to think about? Social pages, all of that sort of stuff in the newspaper. That's the sort of the rubbish in our head sometimes. And it stops us just being here and realizing this moment is all we really need. So this, you start to get some feeling of actually getting a mood of contentment up, just to start with. And if you can start by developing some peace and joy, it's what they say in Anapanasati, it's what they say even in Satipatthana, before you even start practicing your mindfulness meditations, you establish peace. Mindfulness as a priority. Just gently come in here, even before you start watching the breath. It's one of the problems which I found. Fortunately, I had a really good teacher when I first started meditating. But when I went especially to Malaysia, I couldn't believe when I first went to Malaysia, people were asking me, Achambram, I've got samadhi headache. That's what they used to call it, samadhi headache. And a meditation headache. They said, what? I meditate to overcome headaches. I said, no, we meditate, we get them. What are you doing? And he was trying way too hard to meditate. And especially they were just doing the best meditation on the tip of the nose. So I've got to do this demonstration again, do every meditation retreat, take my glasses off. I'm going to meditate on the tip of my nose with my eyelids open. And what you actually do, when you start looking at your tip of your nose with your mind, your eyes follow. And that's what meditators in Malaysia were doing. They had their eyelids closed so they couldn't see what they were up to. They were focusing so hard on there, both eyes were pointed over there. And already I'm beginning to feel tension. If you carry on like that for too long, of course you get samadhi headache. Peace, calmness, tranquility first. That's important. meditation doesn't start when you sit down on a cushion or a chair or a stool and say, now I'm watching the breath. Preparation is so important beforehand. This beautiful feeling of contentment, safety, peace, that is also important. That's one of the reasons why we make sure everyone keeps at least 5 precepts. 8 precepts, great. Because it gives you a sense of safety in this compound here. Nothing to worry about, you're perfectly okay. Even if you ever do, not this time of the year, see the snakes and stuff, they are all Buddhist snakes. So they will not harm you. They're kind, they're gentle, really cute. And so because of that, oh, we had all these snake stories in Thailand. And it's amazing, just all those years I was in the forest, snakes all over the place. Sometimes they crawl up you, sometimes well, it's only once I trod on them, but I sort of jumped the other way pretty quickly and I apologized to the snake. And the poor little snake was as scared as I was. And so I said sorry, and the snake went one way, he apologized, and I went the other way. I remember this one time when I got up early in the morning after the all-night meditation sits, and I got up early in the morning and to go to the toilet, you know, it was quite a ways away. So this was in the jungle, in the forest. You usually squat down, you know, the Asian way of squatting, and you know, urinate in the forest. And first light. So just, you know, the dawn had just broken. And then, a bit sort of tired, been meditating all night, I squatted down, you know, made sure everything was okay, started urinating. And I really did think I was urinating on a stick until the stick started to move. And I realized I was peeing on a snake. And that snake was a very venomous one. And so because, you know, it was a bit dark and just, you know, it was just a bit sort of groggy, and it looked at the snake, and the snake was fine. Never bit me. And I often say this, you know, to the male meditators here. You can imagine that the most sensitive part of your anatomy was so close to that snake's mouth. When I talk about it, ooh, I'm glad it didn't bite. But it just, you know, was very happy. You know why? Because it's very rare that a snake could be blessed with the holiest of holy water. It's either that, it was like a warm bath for a cold snake. Otherwise, it's just very happy. But I wouldn't suggest you try that. But anyway, where's I going with this? Anyway, so when you start to be very, very peaceful and happy, you get really relaxed. You get a bit of inspiration. The happiness, the peace, the relaxation before you do such meditations like the breath. So important, preparation. Even to the point that, you know, this is good enough. You start with that insight, and it becomes really beautiful. One of the other nice, you asked for a guided meditation, I'm going to actually do one now, it's only 5 minutes, unfortunately. You don't have to change your posture, it's 5 minutes. So, as you are, and I'm a hypocrite, I changed mine, posture. But just close your eyes, it's only 5 minutes. 10. Okay, compromise, 7.6 minutes. So you close your eyes. Now, get your body pretty relaxed. Just check your legs and your butt and your back. It's not going to be a long meditation, so. Now, imagine, do some role play. Imagine you're the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. Imagine what it must be like. Really get into the role. Sitting here, peaceful, calm, content. Done what needed to be done. No more work to be performed. No more struggling or striving. Nothing more to be done. Just peacefully experiencing the bliss of contentment, of nothing more to do. Feel a very quiet breeze, like it's coming from the forests, what India dust-free would have been like so many couple of centuries ago. Calm, at ease, with a beautiful meal, milk, rice, fit for a heavenly being. Sitting there, all your work complete. No goals, nothing missing. Just enjoy contentment and peace. There's nothing to want because you have everything you ever needed. Nothing missing. Nothing to strive for. Just being. How does that feel? Knowing that at the end of your life, nothing more to do. Be just like the person who's fully retired from life with a pension of happiness and wisdom. Just sitting. Nothing is incomplete. Nothing is missing. It's all just where it should be. Peace. Contentment. Not needing to change a thing. When you don't want anything, time disappears. Maybe you can work out the insight that is craving, wanting, which creates life. Don't want anything. Time. trying to be aware of anything. Just stop it. Like a Buddha under the Bodhi. Imagine the whole play immersed into the character of an enlightened one. You can see this preparation, you get into the mood, and then it's meditation. Is that good, by the way? Okay. How easy is it to meditate? If you go there and say, okay, sit full lotus, put your right thumb against the left arm, breathe in, come, watch it go in, go out, go in, go out. Something different there, isn't there? Just when you're taught what to do, you're told what to do, and you learn how to get into the mood of meditation first of all. Really get into it. You know, one of the places where I started messing around with this was when I went to Singapore in the Little Gems preschool, trying to do it as a Buddhist preschool. And again, they sort of invited me, can you come and just teach the kids? It was Waysack time. Yeah, I'm not trained as a preschool teacher. What are you supposed to do? So you try and get them to sit down for 5 minutes, and that's just a huge achievement. They're so hyperactive and running around. And so what I did, because it was Waysack, I said, okay, we'll do the three important times with which Waysack represents. First of all, the birth. So imagine you're the baby Buddha, and you take 7 steps. So we'll wait for the 7 steps, and then put your finger up, not the middle one, this one, and just say, I am this is my last life, I am the best. They all got into that, very slowly, because you know, it's a Buddha, you don't run around. And they all imagine being a Buddha, 7 steps. Okay, next, the enlightenment. So all sit down and just cross your legs and imagine you're meditating. Just imagine, don't do it because you can't do it, you're too young to do it, just imagine. And then they were all really quiet for about 5 minutes. I said, we're coming in line under the Bodhi tree. And that was really great. They never meditated so quietly because they weren't meditating, they were just imagining it. Because remember, I remembered at schools, they said, imagine you're a tree swaying in the wind. Did you do that at primary school? Imagine it, or was it just me who was crazy? You really got into it, just you thought as a kid, a tree swaying in the wind, these are your branches. So the role-playing imagination is really great. But then the last one, the third one, was you were the Buddha passing away at Kusinara, lying on your right side. So I got them all to lie on their right side and said, now you're the Buddha passing away, really slowly. And they really got into it. And, you know, I had a bit of peace as well because they were passing away for another 5 or 6 minutes before they reincarnated and became kids again. Well, that was really nice, was because they could actually role play. They can get into it. So why can't we as well? And it also reminded me of this gentleman, a really nice fellow, that I don't mind doing nice anecdotes. That was Peter Sayre. He was a gentleman, he just lived around the corner from Nonamara, an English guy. And He told me, absolutely confirmed, I checked it many times to make sure I wasn't adding or subtracting. He was lived by himself. Actually, he had got a partner soon afterwards. But by himself, and then middle of the night, something was weird. He turned on the light by his bedside, and it was his mother standing at the end of the bed. The only time in his life he's ever seen a ghost. And not just, no, was it something, what was it? Not sort of, you know, imagining it. The light was on, he said, just like someone, like you were standing in front of me right now. You're not a ghost, are you? But they look exactly just like a person was physically there. And he knew that because his mother lived in Essex, in England, he knew that his mum must have died. He's old. And his mum smiled at him, as only a mother can smile at their children. And there's so much warmth and love. And he was just laying in bed there, just looking. Not at all scared, but just accepting so much love and kindness for the last time. And he said he felt so peaceful, he felt so blessed. Not even a moment of fear or the fact this was a weird experience. For about 4 or 5 minutes, 3 or 4 minutes, when his mum visited him. And then right before his eyes, he just faded away, just disappeared into nothingness. And then, being from England, what did he do? Get up and make a cup of tea. What the English always do in times of trouble. Have a cup of tea. And that's why when Ajahn Chah came back from visiting England, well, I remember we asked him, you went to England, did you learn any English words? And he said, yes, only one. Cup of tea. It cracked us up when he said that. That's the only English word in another language he ever learned, cup of tea. So anyway, so he had a cup of tea, and that's when his sister rang from England. Pete got some bad news. Yeah, mum's died. How did you know? Oh, she just came to visit me. And it's the only time he's ever done anything freaky like that. And he said, it's such a wonderful thing. You know, if it's your loved one passes away on the other side of the world, and they come and see you, especially if it's a mother and their child. What a beautiful thing that was. Real, you know, 3 or 4 minutes. But he was also the one, he said he could never watch his breath, do breath meditation. We had this teacher, gave this very wonderful skillful means. He said, well, you know, just don't try and watch your breath, but sit down, close your eyes now. Imagine you're watching your breath. Just imagine, like play it. Imagine what it'd be like if you could watch your breath. Imagine it. And so he closed his eyes, he was imagining watching his breath, and the teacher said, what are you watching? My breath. Because all it was is this block, I can't meditate, or I can't be still, or I can't stop my mind, or I can't do this and that. It's just a psychological block, and it's a beautiful skillful means of getting around that. I can't be peaceful, so imagine you're the Buddha. Don't say, oh, that's very disrespectful. Now, if it works, I think the Buddha will be very happy. He gets some peace. That's the whole point of him staying all those years. Or him, can't we say it's the Buddha is a him or her male body, but that's not the Buddha. So when you actually see what this really is, that you can do it using these skillful means. When you get that preparation to begin with, the rest is very easy. And of course the other things is one of the reasons I try my best to give talks, and because it's not just wasting time, trying to get some happiness, some lightness, some joy, and hopefully every now and again some inspiration. And sometimes the inspiration is what really can drive the meditation so deep. Because even, you know, when I said, you asked me about Bahia, and now those words were enough to get him enlightened. Remember, this was a gentleman, an ascetic, who had and I'd never seen a Buddha before. Imagine the inspiration of actually finding a Buddha and actually being in the presence of a Buddha. That would be just so inspiring. And just how that can create such an amazing sense of peace. That brings me on to the story of my teaching anecdotes of one of my favorite monks, you know, as well as Ajahn Chah, and that was that monk Ajahn Tate, the story of Ajahn Tate. He was one of the earliest disciples of Ajahn Mun. He was one of these monks. When I first went to Thailand, he was in the hospital being looked after by the king, cancer, and it got to the point, no other treatment possible. So he said, well, if I'm going to die, I might as well die in my monastery, which was at in Nong Khai province, Sri Chiang Mai. That's not the Chiang Mai in the north, another Sri Chiang Mai, on the Mekong River, and Him Mak Peng. And he went to stay there to die. It was about 25 years afterwards when he finally passed away. It took him a long time to die. These monks, you know, we're not in the fast lane, we're just slow. Even dying, we take our time. So, there he was. But he was one of these wonderful monks. And so, you know that I knew that he was a great monk, and now I had the time, I could speak Thai. So I wanted to go and visit him. I had all these questions to ask. And that was when I got to eventually see him and just make an appointment. Even a monk, you had to make an appointment. And when I actually got into his presence, you know what happened? All these really important questions I've come such a long way to ask, they evaporated. No questions in there at all, in my mind. It was so peaceful, picking up on his really wonderful energy, kindness, peace. I didn't want anything in the whole world, just to be there. Wonderful experience of just how peace happens. You don't have to be perfect. You have to be accepted. You don't need to have lots of effort. You just have this wonderful thing called stopping. This openness, gentleness, which everything just gets soaked away. You're so still and peaceful. And I must have looked like a fool. Just come all this way and just sitting there saying nothing. And so, and Ajahn Tate just asked me a few questions. But I didn't really want to move at all. I was totally still. And a thought did come into my mind. I'd have to get some elephants. I didn't have tractors over there. Elephants to drag me out of here. I'm not moving. That's like samadhi. So still. You can't move. Not because of effort, but because of contentment. So content, so at peace, so happy. You don't want anything else in the whole world. It's still. The mind doesn't move, no questions needed. Because questions are just more irritations of the mind. When you have stillness and peace right in front of you, you don't investigate. It's there. You don't have to dig the hole. You have it in your hand. So this is actually where real insight happens. When it's right in front of you and you can't miss it. You don't explore and search for it. It's come to you. So that's the examples, the happiest moment of your life so far. Why? Because you didn't want anything. You were content. Just the peaceful meditations. You never strove for them. Yeah, they happen when you stop striving. That's why it's this, you know, sometimes I tell people, okay, we decided to finish the retreat early, after lunch today. We've only got another hour to go. So I say that because, oh, another hour, I haven't got anything now. Well, I'm not going to get anything now, just the last hour, so you give up. And that's when people get deep meditation. When they stop trying. Happened to so many people that, oh, the last minute meditation successes. There was a well known, well, not well known, but it's well known by the nuns over there, person came to one of my retreats over in Thailand, thing in Khao Lak retreat. She'd been trying to meditate and get something for for 8-9 days. A really great woman. And she was getting nowhere. Really smart. Very sort of keeping precepts. And she was trying. Then we finished the retreat. She got nowhere. So of course you're a bit sort of disappointed. And then it was another hour before her taxi came to take her to the airport. She was had to go back to KL. So what did she do? Ah, she just meditated to kill time. I remember saying that, just meditated to kill time. And after the killing time for one hour, she came up to me, and I'd always remember this. She was on the floor, she was looking up at me and said, Oh, I jumped, it's so wonderful. It was so sweet. The only thing, you know, well, I don't know, because it's like someone they just fallen in love, and just everything is just so wonderful. She was so not excited winning the lottery, so she just got her first deep meditation. And I always remember that because she wasn't trying. She'd given up, hopeless. Or the Ananda method of enlightenment. Not this one, but another one. Which is, you know, it's fine, but it's also so deep. There's Ananda, the Buddha's attendant for so many years, and the Buddha was passing away, and the Ananda still wasn't enlightened. And so he just basically, the poor old Ananda, just think, if I can't get enlightened when the great teacher's there, just when am I going to get enlightened? And a few months later on, they decide to hold this massive, very important meeting of all the senior Sangha, actually to get all of the teachings together. And they decided they can only get 500. Let's have 500 fully enlightened beings, 500 arahats. But then there was this fellow called Ananda, this monk who was not enlightened, but had been next to the Buddha for so many years, had a very good memory. So he said, let's make an exception, we'll invite him as well. So 499 fully enlightened beings, and one was Ananda. Now, imagine that was you. You go, oh, feel so out of place. Oh, my friends and colleagues, get some idea. I usually tell this story towards the end of the retreat. Imagine I made the announcement that all the people on this retreat all were fully enlightened, except for you. That hurts. So poor old Ananda was really embarrassed. So, go for it. All night he meditated. Enlightenment or bust? Again. Bust. The dawn came up and he still wasn't enlightened. And really, everything, every trick in the book, everything he'd learned sitting next to the Buddha, everything, nothing worked. Have you had that experience before? So what he did, he said, well, there's another hour before the meeting starts, so I'll just go and take a nap. So he went into his room, and where's he laid down before his head hit the pillow? The 500th arahat. Why? I should say what happened next, first of all, because after he became enlightened, you know, he decided they're not going to believe me, you know, just at the last minute. So he made sure he was late getting to the meeting. And when they had the meeting, 499, Ananda was a nurse, so they locked the door. And after locking the door, this beam of light came through the keyhole and emerged Ananda. It's called making an entrance. to show that he deserved his place as the 500th arahat in the meeting. So, but the most important part of that, how it works. He just gave up. He let go. He didn't want anything anymore, because he just realized all the effort wasn't getting him anywhere. And that's how he became enlightened. And to this day, we call this in Jhana Grove the Ananda Method of Enlightenment. So after lunch, but the reason why it works, and this is some of the great insights of learning, pretending you're the Buddha, or just the most peaceful, is, oh yeah, just a quick one. One of my favorite little similes was the donkey and the carrot simile. When you understand this, you understand how Ananda became enlightened. The donkey and the carrot. A donkey is very stubborn. And if you hit the donkey won't move. So, instead of hitting the donkey, you tie the stick to the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you tie a string. On the end of the string, you tie a carrot. If you like carrots, that is. If you are, say, from Indonesia, it might be a piece of durian. You like durian, Bunga? Yeah, okay, I put a bit of durian on there. Oh. If you are from, say, Thailand, what would it be? Mango, durian? Mango, put a bit of mango on. If you are from UK, want to put some fish and chips? Whatever. Whatever you're from. So you put that in the front. In Canada. Sorry? Hamburger. You know what? See, what's the thing that Canada produces and no other country in the world produces? What Canada produces, no other country in the world produces. Do you know that one? No. Maybe so we get that from northern US as well. You should know this. The only thing which Canada produces, which no other country in the world produces, is Canadians. You should have seen that coming. So anyway, back to the donkey. Alright, so okay, if you're from Korea, kimchi. So you can imagine the donkey then is lovely kimchi right in front. No, Amanda loves kimchi. You must have been from Korea in your last life, Amanda. So anyway, I've got the carrot. See the carrot in front of the donkey. The donkey runs after the carrot. Because the donkey runs after the carrot, the string moves, the stick moves, the string moves, the carrot moves. So no matter how fast you run after the carrot's always 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. You can never catch up with it. If a durian, you run really hard, the durian's always 2 foot in front. But the donkey has been to one of Ajahn Brahm's retreats. Little donkeys. The donkey knows how to catch the carrots or the durian, whatever it is. The donkey stops. Stop. Stop doing things. Let go. Give up. Sit here. Stop wanting things. Stop interfering. Take your hand off the steering wheel. Feet off the pedals. Just let go. You know what happens? The carrot goes further away. And you think, oh, it's not working. So you start running after it again. No. Be patient. So the carrot goes further and further away until it's 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. Never been so far away before. You're falling asleep. The mind is running all over the place. Ajahn Brahm, you know, it's not working. You know, I'm just fantasizing, falling asleep, nothing's happening. I should go back to my old method of forcing the mind and sitting down and disciplining myself. Just hold on for a bit longer. And then, 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth, and then a piece of durian starts coming towards you. Wow, you've never seen this before. You're not doing anything. All these wonderful experiences, you're sitting here.
and you can see the breath. It's easy. And then the breath becomes really beautiful. The peace of kimchi is coming closer, Amanda's. Man, it's in its usual place, 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. It's a wonderful piece of sweetest mango right in front. And you don't do anything because it's going at top speed towards you. And as it comes closer and closer towards you, what do? The donkey has to remember the last piece of instruction. Not just being still. It's kindness, compassion. That's really important at all stages of the meditation, especially for enlightenment. But just as a piece of fish and chips or durian or mango or kimchi, just before it comes in to the hopper for Sri Lanka. You like hoppers? Just before it comes into your mouth, you always have to remember compassion. Durian, the door of my mouth is open to you. Otherwise it flashes off your teeth. That's how you catch the carrot, the durian. You've been chasing after it long enough. Now you stop and let go. And it comes towards you. The Ananda method of meditation. Now there's a heap of insight in that. All the trying, all the struggle, it stops you becoming enlightened. Restrain. Let go. Renounce. Be happy to be here. Open the door of your heart to this moment. That is how peace, bliss, and freedom develop. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. So any questions?